jumped into it here. I'm trying to think. We've got an hour and a half left. I want to, let me just reiterate again that I'm not trying to advocate you change, you know, your preaching style or your writing techniques and so forth. I've just, some of this you're probably already doing. Other things you just won't be interested in. It's just kind of, this is one other maybe approach, you know, for occasional use or you know, partial use or whatever. So, the way this is, and this is really what, I mean, I'm just telling you really what I do at this point, and how I go about the task of sermon writing in the life of the parish. And I'm not even sure how this was developed. I wasn't taught this at seminary, but it didn't develop in isolation. I know other people do this. This is what I do. I print off the bulletin first thing Monday morning, or you know, the Saturday night the week before for the coming Sunday, and then I take the bulletins with me for the coming Sunday because they have the readings in them to all of my calls, and without any preparation at all, no idea what the reading even is. You know, I mean, often. You know, I go to the shut-in, set up communion, we go through the liturgy, we get to the gospel, and I read the gospel for the very first time, and then I preach on it to the shut-in, off the cuff, extemporaneously. And then, same thing at the hospital, same thing with all the calls that I'm making. And I do this then all week long. That's my major sermon preparation. Now, sometimes, depending on how things go, I may have actually looked at, I mean, I may have started some kind of exegetical work and so forth, but actually for me, the ideal thing is I haven't, because I find that I think I do better, personally, if I'm actually talking to a living human being about the gospel, rather than sort of, you know, looking up words in a dictionary, I know this is sort of, this, at least in the Missouri Synod, this is almost heresy, but I find commentaries to be almost worthless. I never consult commentaries. Commentaries are sometimes helpful for Bible study. I don't find commentaries helpful, including the Concordia commentaries, for preaching. So your experience may be different, but that's my... So the advantage of this, in any case, whether you want to do it exactly this way, what I really do think everybody should be doing is making calls. I think that a calling pastor is a pastor, and making calls will feed your preaching. Sitting in your office, you know, and just sort of seeing your people as it's forced upon you by meetings and so forth does not do much for preaching. And it doesn't really do that much for pastoral care either. So I think this is what you, this idea of calling, then this is really where we connect with the people. So if I don't have a very big church, and I don't have that many shut-ins. I only have 6 shut-ins. And a couple of those are in the nursing home. I knock them out at the same time. So I don't have that many shut-in calls to make. I just make up calls to make. You know, I just go see somebody. Because I need that interaction. And it's good for parish life in my estimation. So, and the other thing that's good about it is, you know, when you go home for supper, you feel like you can say, well, at least I did something. You've got some objective thing. You actually did something that actually was, you know, ministry rather than... Obviously, you can tell from what I'm saying. I know there's been lots of days I didn't, so I try to do that. What calling does, I think, it helps prevent or it helps counteract the kind of negative side of things where the pastor's just going through the motions, or, you know, the cliches we hear from people. Well, hopefully not about ourselves, but maybe, or often, unfortunately, we're always hearing this about the neighboring pastors, right? Well, he's asleep at the wheel, or he just goes through the motions, and blah, blah, blah. Well, I think calling actually helps that, because, again, you're connecting to the lives of people. The other thing that comes out of this for me is that I will actually write a sermon for one person. And I find that these are actually the best sermons. At least they're the best sermons in that the congregation finds them the most applicable. nobody knows I'm writing to one person. They all think I'm writing to them. Yeah.
I was going to say, but then that one person doesn't come, right?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter if he comes because I'm not. It's universal enough. I mean, I'm writing sometimes to a shut-in who I know won't be there. But what'll happen is this is the way. I mean, and you may not work this way, but I'll be with a shut-in, or I'll be at the hospital, or I'll have a premarital thing, or I'll have a fight with a member, or what all the stuff you do in a week, and something will stick in me. I'll go, holy crap, this person is just lonely. This is just pitiful, And then out of that, I'll be like, well, what does this person, need to hear from this gospel? How does this speak to that deep loneliness? Well, the shut-in's not going to be there, but I'm thinking of her very concretely, or of her particular pain. Now I'm not bringing out details, in the sermon, but it's in the Elizabeth text or the Nativity of St. John. I mean, it's just easy to think of all sorts of women and couples I know that are suffering, from barrenness, which is an odd thing to suffer from in our society because we don't want to admit it's a cross. we think it's a curse when you get pregnant. So that's where I think the calling kind of thing and picking one person is for me a very helpful thing. It's very difficult for me to preach to a group like you because I don't know you. So what I try to do is make up somebody. If I have to go into a situation where I don't know who I'm preaching to, I just simply imagine someone. And it might be false, but I mean, there's enough people that you know that you can just kind of. Because if you just try to do this, I don't know. That's my yeah, Dave.
Well, there's a significant difference between your first sermon and one today, so you've been making calls on us.
Yeah. Well, you were encouraged to think about sex this time.
Yes, we were.
The other thing that I really do think is important, I'm going through this sort of quickly because I want to get through this stuff, but is to get this text in your mind right away early in the week. Because whether you just read it quickly through in English or you take it to a shut-in, because you need to be sort of working on this sermon in the background all the time. Or I should say you need to be. I think you will be better off if you are. And it's what will happen if you've got this text in your mind, particularly if you're taking it to calls every day, thoughts will come to you unbidden, in the middle of the night, in the shower, when you're driving. And that's not accidental. They're unbidden, but they weren't unprepared for. They are coming because you've been doing this work and you're thinking of these things. So then you're ready for them. Whereas if you haven't picked up the text, I mean, you just don't have those opportunities. So again, this just living with this text for a week is so much better in my experience than sitting down with a commentary and trying to crash through it exegetically. So that's the sort of first thing. The second thing that I would advocate is that we should all be striving to master the extemporaneous simple law gospel sermon. And that, again, for me is the advantage of doing this with shut-ins and hospital calls and so forth. Now, that's not saying that what you say to the shut-in on Monday or even on Friday is going to be what ends up being in the sermon on Sunday. Because at least in my experience, it often isn't. But it gets you thinking, when you're standing at the hospital bed and you've just got some, the text that's assigned for Sunday, and then all of a sudden you just, right now, here and now, you've got to, make this an application of the love of Jesus Christ for this person. That's a great skill to have. And what is that except really, giving a witness to the faith that is in us? I mean, it's really just, I mean, to think back to, you're really just witnessing. you're just. It's like it's like standing up, making cold calls and trying to give a gospel witness. It's really what we're doing there at the bedside or whatever is not that much different. And that will, as you do that over and over, I think, you find that. So I think that we should all be able to really, not that I want to do this to us, and I don't want this done to me, but really every one of us should be ready without any notice at all to stand up and give a sermon. I mean, you know, you really, we could, and I, what I had on here, what I was going to try to do, but I don't think we've got time, and it would take a long time. It would be fun to try that. I wanted to sort of, we'll just open up the Bible, you know, boom, and then, and let's just see where it goes. Because I think if you haven't done that, you'll be surprised how good at it you are. So you know, and to develop that kind of ability, I think is important for us if we're preachers. Because it's going to carry over into formal sermons also. All right, enough on that sort of technique stuff.
Not only that, it'll get rid of those nightmares that we have of losing our manuscript.
That's right. Yeah.
Or better yet, go ahead and put your manuscript on the pulpit before you even go down to Bible class, and then coming up from the Bible class realizing it's gone.
This happened to me, actually, and it actually happened to me only about 3 weeks ago. And I didn't know it until I stepped into the pulpit. And I preached without a manuscript. I was like, well, what are you gonna do? The only problem with it really was it was long. We were talking this morning about the advantage of manuscripts. I think I'm not against preaching without a manuscript. I do it. That time I did it on accident, but I do it several times a year on Sunday. I do it a lot on our weekday services. And again, I think it's a good skill to have. And there's a lot of advantages to it. The people like it. My fear, again, with my own set of, you know, weaknesses and abilities, is that when I preach without a manuscript, I get repetitive.
Yeah.
And I know that my sermons are always longer when I preach it. Now, but they don't really mind it. But I think if I did it all the time, they just wouldn't be as pointed. I hope it works out some year, that you guys get Carl Fakencher up here, who I really love. But my sermon style, which you guys haven't exactly seen, but is what Fakencher calls a very literary style. And my sermons are pretty formal and constructed. But, it, you know, that's the context of the parish and all that. But I like that, and I think there's, you know, in my context, that really works well. So without a manuscript, you just don't have that. You don't have those precise, well-crafted phrases and so forth. And I have a pretty literary congregation, though, like everybody, you know, I've got some very, you know, super educated people, professors at the seminary and such, but then, of course, we also have people who can't read. I mean, you've got the gamut. But. So, anyway, the extemporaneous sermon, I think we should be ready for it. If you haven't done some of that, I would encourage you to try it. Just force yourself to do it, because I think it's a skill that's worth having. I wouldn't advocate doing it all the time because I think also, besides the repetition, it can be possible to become lazy and to not do the work of actually preparing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, that's not right either. But all right, so I want to talk about, because this is an interesting topic to me, is this: how do we find content and how do we break writer's block? Because we just all face that, right? I would say that the easiest literary sermon to write, we talked about this morning at breakfast, is to preach on the narratives. I find it at least far easiest to preach on the miracles, or, you know, Jesus went here and did this, and the parables. I find it very difficult to preach on the epistles, or to preach on, like, the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus is preaching. I find that very difficult. I find Saints' Days the easiest sermons to write because there's a story. And that for me, is the easiest. And the easiest sermon for me to write, and I would think it should be for all of us, is when it's a narrative text and you simply retell the story. Now, it was funny. Who said he didn't? That was you, wasn't it? Is it Greg or Gary? I'm sorry, Gary. Said his people don't like it when he does that. I'm surprised to hear that because I find people... My people like it, and it's I don't want to do it all the time because, I mean, I think there needs to, sometimes you need to do more. But just retelling the story and kind of just slipping in, you know, theological observations or applications to them is a very easy sermon to write, and, you know, it flows pretty well. So along with the kind of extemporaneous law gospel witness type sermon, I think the other kind of skill that ought to be, you know, basic in our arsenal is we can retell the story. And I would say that like unto the kind of canned, ready-to-go law gospel sermons, we should have some, there should be some texts that we can pick up and preach on in this narrative way without, because we've already, like, for instance, the wedding at Cana, the Good Samaritan, you know, texts that are very familiar, we've preached on a lot, right? We ought to have that down enough that we could stand up and we can tell the story of, you know, I mean, you pick it, you know, lowering the paralytic through the roof, you know, or whatever it is. We know the whole thing. We know it through and through. We've told the story enough. And the other advantage of this, if you really kind of, you've done that kind of preaching on that text really thoroughly so that you can do it, you could easily do it without a manuscript, what happens then in years to come is you know the story and you can really preach on it. So it doesn't have to always be. So, again, it's a kind of foundational thing to fall back on, but also because it's actually building skills that you're using for other sermons. So just like the extemporaneous law gospel sermon has its immediate purpose, but it also teaches you or, you know, develops these preaching muscles, this kind of narrative form, I think, does the same thing. All right, so those are then the writer's block thing. What do you do when you just can't write? The first thing to do is simply external discipline. Writer's block is just laziness. It's all it is. We just don't want to do the work because it's hard. So we allow ourselves to drift off, to daydream. You know, we just don't want to expend the mental energy that's necessary. So I mean, we need to know this so that we don't, you know, allow ourselves to be paralyzed by it and pretend like we can't write because we have writer's block. Well, writer's block we do to ourselves. What do you want?
Just on occasion I'll be in that situation and I will just write and then I'll come back to it later and it'll think.
Yeah.
But then I'll preach against what I just wrote.
Yeah, exactly. I've got down here one of the best I think ways to handle this is to just write anything that comes into your head, just start typing. And you've got some. You just say, I'm refuse to look at this blank screen. I mean, if you're going to write on here, this screen is blank. I don't want it to be. You just start. Stream of consciousness. Don't worry about spelling or punctuation. You just type as fast as you can, and you see where it goes. And it will often all of a sudden, whoop, there's an idea, and then you know it's broken.
It's kind of like that marriage relationship. There, sometimes you have to put the work into it, whether you don't feel like it.
That's right.
I'm quite serious.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's kind of the way I tend to look at it.
Yeah.
You have the same problem in painting when that big blank canvas is there, and it's intimidating. So you just got to put a horizon in and put the lines in, and you're going to get rid of them after.
That's great. I didn't know. I don't paint, but that makes perfect sense to me. This sounds exactly the same.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing, so what are the external disciplines? We'll get to the writing thing in a minute. The external discipline, the first thing you need, besides making calls on your people, the next thing you need is a disciplined devotional life. You know, again, and my advice for this is, pray matins or some prayer office publicly in your church every day at a scheduled time. Why? Because if you publicize it and you say, we're going to have matins here at 9 o'clock, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, whatever it is, and then you have to do it because somebody might show up. I mean, they probably won't, and if they do, great. You know. But the thing is that you put it on there, you're blocking it out, the parish knows, and I just tell the people, look, they say, well, we can't come, we got to work, it's just fine. I don't care. I mean, look, I will be praying for you at this point. This is the time. We have the scheduled public prayer. This is when the prayers of the church will be offered on your behalf. And then, I mean, it's just, then I have to do it because I don't know if they're going to come or not. Whereas if I, you know, it's so easy. Oh, I'm going to check my email. I'm going to, you know, right? So, you know, I mean, you can do what you want. I mean, I'm not saying it has to be matins or, but if you invite the congregation, you make it a public part of your schedule, it just prevents you from skipping. Because look, how good are we at doing family devotions? I don't know, when you, we do it after dinner, but I mean, it's just, you know, we do it for a while, then we quit for a while. Everybody pretends like you forgot. I mean, it's just stupid. But, you know, right? But I mean, like, but nobody wants to do it, so we just, you know, I'll have our prayer and get out of here. So, that's kind of external, but because your devotional life will feed your preaching, again. So, I mean, if you're not making calls, if you're not reading the scriptures, and I don't mean reading the scriptures for sermon prep, I mean reading the scriptures devotionally. That's, again, it's external discipline. This is a scripture, a Bible reading schedule that I'm following, a psalm. You know, that's the other thing. The psalms are very easy to preach on because the psalms are experiential. Right, we know what they're describing because we felt it. So you're praying the Psalms that will feed your preaching. The next thing is you're gonna hate this. You've got to remove your distractions. Turn off the stupid internet. There are actually programs you can download that will do this. You know, you can tell it, don't let me back on for. it's a good idea to have one of those programs also that blocks pornography. But there are these programs you can buy that will, like, you know, not allow you to check your email for a half an hour, or, you know, like, now I'm so, oh, this is so great, we have DSL at the church. We got it a year ago. And we had a DSL at home for about 2 years. It was, you know, it was fine. We got it at church. I mean, it's because I don't use it at home. You know, what do you do at home on the internet? Right? I mean, but boy, is that nice a church. But I mean, the problem is it's on all the time, so you know, it's like, oh, you got a new email. Oh, you got a new email, right? So it interrupts your work. Well, you got to turn that crap off. You know what? We've got answering machines. Don't answer the stupid phone. What, really? What can't wait 30 minutes? I mean, I had a couple of times where they wanted me to carry around a cell phone so they could get a hold of me all the time. I said, forget it. But look, if you guys are in such terrible straits that, you know, your kid's dying on the side of the road and you don't know how to pray, well, if you can't pray, then, you know, there's not a lot I'm going to be able to do for you. I mean, if I can be there, I will be there and I will pray with you and I will pray for you and so forth. But come on, you're Christian people. You can pray yourselves, right? So I don't think, you know, a half hour delay is that significant. And, you know, come on, how many times have you guys been called out in the middle of the night to go see somebody in your years of ministry? 15 years, I've done it 3 times. I mean, it's just not, I don't find it a common thing. So you can wait on the phone for a half hour. But set a time limit, you know, it's a discipline. And I quoted here, there's a great article in the New York Times this past spring that I ran across about multitasking. Multitasking is a myth. You cannot do two things at once. The mechanism of attention is selection. It is either this or that. This is Ms. Gallagher. Points to calculations. This is a scientific study. The typical person's brain can process only so many pieces of information over a lifetime. People don't understand that attention, quote, people don't understand that attention is a finite resource like money. Do you want to invest your cognitive cash on endless twittering or net surfing or couch potatoing? You're constantly making choices, and your choices determine your experience, just as this poet said. So that kind of goes with the Stoic thing, too, back to Aristotle. It's not what happens to you, it's how you react to it. But there really is something to this. That, I mean, I know in my own, when I have to do reading, academic reading, if I can focus and concentrate, I mean, thick, you know, stuff, I can read 25 to 30 pages an hour. That's my top speed, but it requires focus and concentration. If I'm not trying to read and trying to get through it, you know, I mean, making notes in the margins, I mean, reading seriously. If I'm not doing that, it takes me 3 times as long. So, I mean, you know, you can force yourself to say, I'm going to focus on this and read this, and you can do the same sort of thing with your sermon prep. So, I know I sound like a schoolmaster up here, but I actually am trying to be encouraging. All right, so then the next thing is write for the edit. That's what I call it. You just forget quality, forget orthodoxy. Because I'm just a vulgar person, as you probably know by now. When I'm doing this, I'll just cuss while I'm writing. I mean, I'll put cuss words right in it because it's just exactly how I think. So I'm writing. I mean, you guys would be scandalized. In fact, my wife. What's an example? I saw yesterday when I said shit. I saw the district president laugh.
Yeah.
And I was thinking worse than shit, but my wife saw. Because of the way that this thing had worked, she just happened to. My kids have this laptop computer. It's really their computer, but you know, once a year or something, I take it away. And I mean, to bring it like to this, and I had some notes for this St. Elizabeth sermon, and just this kind of stuff. And my wife happened to see it. Because there was some, it was calmed down for you guys this morning. So anyway, I mean, just write. Be angry, right? I mean, be sinful. I mean, if you're saying, you know, I don't understand you, God. I think you're just. Why are you doing this to me? Why are you doing this to them? Why don't you answer prayers? Why are you know, like the Psalms, right? I mean, look at how they wrestle with God. And again, what will happen for me sometimes is that I'm just reacting to the text. You know, I'm saying to myself, why does Elizabeth get to have a baby? You know, why isn't everybody get this? You know, or whatever. And then from that, you know, sometimes a sermon will come. Sometimes law, sometimes gospel. I mean, it works both ways. So I find that a good way to do it. I start out angry. Almost always, because that's the fallen flesh's favorite emotion, right? So I start out angry. I'm mad I have to write this sermon. I'm mad that this text is so dense and doesn't say anything that's helpful. I'm mad about whatever. But as I'm writing, it changes. I mean, as I'm just cranking it out. And the other idea, of course, is just exactly what Dave said. The other thing is that, you know, you just, what'll happen if I'll just expose my own sinfulness in my writing, and then I've got law to preach. I mean, I'll see it, and then I end up preaching against my own gut reactions to this text, or my own baser desires as they came out. Why? You know, I can because of course my problem is one of my problems. I'm just bored. I mean, there's just this irreverence in me that oh come on, this again. You know, how much more can I say about this? And, you know, then all of a sudden, I mean, I catch, I mean, talk about sinfulness. Well, that was the sermon, who preached that? Bored with the Resurrection, right? That was, yeah. Easter, for me, I'm coming around on Easter quite a bit, actually. Because I can remember when I was I can remember my first years in the ministry, I had almost no idea how to preach on Easter. I was just a Good Friday preacher. Loved Good Friday. And more and more and more over the years, I've become more and more of an Easter preacher, I think. And part of that's actually been the liturgy, because I love this proper preface. Chiefly are we bound to praise thee for the resurrection. Why? You know, and then to see how that fits. And now, it's funny how you're always kind of, right, evolving, changing. Your emphasis has changed. Luther's emphasis has changed over the years. Now I'm starting to see more of an emphasis on the ascension than I ever saw before. I was always just kind of the doctrinal people thing. Oh, well, this means men can go to heaven. He's opened heaven for mankind. Well, there's a lot more. You don't believe that? He hasn't?
No, I don't
believe it. There's more to it than that. Yeah, of course there is. Yeah. All right. Well, this idea of writing, I find the other thing, if you're just up against it, write out that extemporaneous law gospel sermon, and just walk away. Now I got a sermon I can preach on Sunday morning. So what if it's simple? That was another sermon this week. Who preached this? That was you again. That was the same sermon, wasn't it? The Easter sermon. Yeah. So it's not deeply profound. Or a new expression of the gospel. It's just the same old thing.
Just leave it.
No, that was his line.
That was the jab.
So, I mean, write out that law gospel sermon, your just kind of simple shut-in sermon, and leave it there and walk away. You've fulfilled your duty. You've preached law and gospel to the people. That's what they need. The other kind of thing I will do to myself that I find helpful in this is I will try to imagine again someone I love, because I'm an emotional writer, so I have to have emotion to write. If I get into a fight with one of my members in the morning over something, you know, closed communion or whatever, that's it. I can't get anything done the rest of the day. I'm just a mess. I wish I wasn't like this, but that's my makeup. And so I have to sort of manufacture this emotion in order to write. That's why it's really hard if I don't know who I'm preaching to. But so what I will do sometimes when I'm up against it, I will just imagine, like, you know, one of my children, you know, dying on the side of the road or something. Or I'll just imagine what is it that if I die on the way home, what, you know, and then they're going to come in, oh, Dad's dead, it's so sad, what's the last thing you wrote? You know, this is what they'll find on my computer screen. And that has often freed me to really preach the gospel. Because, you know, I'm looking for some way to get myself through this blank screen and get something so I can preach. And imagining those sorts of things for me enables me to really preach the gospel. And when you're, you know, when I'm thinking of my children and what I want them to know or whatever, that helps. Another thing I will do, you know, I just tried to throw stuff out there because I know we're up against it. I'll just write law, and then I'll just write any law thing I can think of, even cliches, just, you know, and then I'll write gospel, and then I'll just do gospel stuff. I mean, it's just this, again, this to try to get the thing rolling, you know. And sometimes I'll end up preaching against what I wrote. Sometimes an idea will spring from it. But, you know, again, I'm not talking about, this isn't the ideal thing. This is when you're hitting a stumbling block or you're out of time and so forth. Get something on the page so it can be edited. Right? Write for the edit. I think that we don't know enough about writing. And I have found, like with my own children, and I've seen this in my classmates, I think of myself, by the way, primarily as a writer. That's kind of my self-definition. It's not true, obviously, I'm a pastor, but I think of myself as a writer. And so the problem I see is that we've learned this sort of theory of composition, you know, rough draft, outlining, first draft, final draft, right? But my experience is what people do is they write what's a rough draft, and then they do a spell check, and now it's a final draft. And they're, you know, and if they're going to outline it, it's totally artificial. They're just, you know, I know I'm supposed to have an outline, so I got to please the English teacher. And a lot of us haven't proceeded beyond that fake the rough draft scenario from high school or freshman comp, and we're still doing that. Well, I'm trying to tell you there's actually something to this. Write an actual rough draft that actually isn't, you know, your final thing. And sometimes I think non-writers in particular feel like they've got to write perfect sentences and paragraphs and so forth from the get-go. So forget that. Just let it be rough. And then edit it. Because editing, I mean, even though writers hate this, when somebody else edits their work, the truth is editing almost invariably improves writing. Right? What Luther needed desperately was an editor. Now this will probably tick off somebody, but what J.R.R. Tolkien needed was an editor. editing, so learn to edit your stuff. Write rough drafts and then edit. Don't try to write final drafts. You're making it more painful than it needs to be. A few ideas for staying fresh, or for, again, this kind of generating ideas. I think that obviously coming to things like retreats and conferences will hopefully be helpful, not just obviously from the presentations, which you can either react against or, you know, there's, and you could always take any experience and use it. Whether it does, you don't have to agree with the guy for it to be beneficial to you, right? I mean, if it's didn't you, and you have to sometimes you have to put some work into it. But I mean, you can. The only word I can think of is stimulate. I'm trying to avoid it. You can stimulate yourself if the speaker isn't, you know, and you can react against it. I know it. Sorry. You know, you can't. It's not like you have stopped thinking about sex. So you can't exactly point out the
word. Now again.
So you know, we really should take advantage of those opportunities, that kind of stuff. But some maybe less obvious things are listen to books or even better lectures on tape or CD. You know, especially if you're a calling pastor, you're spending a lot of time in the car. You can, if you guys ever heard of these great courses, how many of you have subscribed? How many of you are right-wing conspiracists? If you subscribe to National Review, anybody subscribe to National Review? Well, it's not the Canadian National Review. It's
American.
Well, anyway, they advertise in there. They advertise in the Atlantic Monthly. They advertise in kind of these highbrow type. But there's there are several companies that put out college courses on CD. One of them is called The Teaching Company, and the other one is called Modern Scholar. And Barnes & Noble has picked up some of the Modern Scholar titles, and you can get them very inexpensively, like $35 to $40. But you can get them even cheaper if you get them in a library. Learn to use interlibrary loan. The Teaching Company courses are $180 or more. They're just outrageous expensive, but you're just going to listen to it and then drop it. What they do is they've taken, like, these college professors from English-speaking countries and that have won these various awards for classroom presentation and lectures in various fields. And they put out a course on, you know, whatever they're an expert on, you know, what they teach in college, physics or mathematics. But there's a lot of history, philosophy, English. These things are really phenomenal. To be, you know, ancient civilization. If you pop this, I pop these CDs in the car, and I mean, I'm so enthralled, I don't want to get out of the car. So don't tell my wife, but what will happen to me is, you know, I'll go home, I'm listening to these lectures, I love it. It's just great. So my time in the car is energizing. You know, and I want to go see the shut-ins because I want to hear the next part of the lecture. Because these guys are good. No, I mean, not evenly. Some are better than others. But so I'll go home at night, you know, it's supper time, whatever. Oh, somebody's got, you know, we're out of milk, whatever. Somebody's got to run. Oh, okay, fine. I'll run to the store. Well, I can't wait to hop back in the car and turn the CD on, you know. I mean, so it's really a great way. And, you know, that's okay. Maybe you're not into the try it because I think you'll like it. But if it doesn't, you know, you can't find a topic or things, try books on tape.
Sorry, what was the name of the cheaper one?
The Modern Scholar is the name of the company, and Barnes & Noble is where you get them cheap.
That's what
you But, you know, there's just...
The Teaching Company has them on sale a lot.
Yeah, that's right.
I picked up a few for $20.
Well, that's cheap. But I'm cheaper. I don't pay for any of them. I get them all from the library.
That's $20.
For a while, that was more than 20. That was more than American for a while, but now it's pretty even, isn't it? Again,
getting close. Yeah.
You'll
find it when you
get
your own area.
$3. Well, the other thing you can do this is a Donald Duffner thing, but read good literature, and if you're not a reader. Then, you know, get them on CD or get them on tape, and you're in the car, redeem the time, because this stuff will stimulate you. I mean, it will be engaging, and it will get you thinking, and it will connect you with stuff. And I think it's very good to get outside also of our discipline. I've listened to courses, lots of on philosophy, I mean, in history, but, you know, things even like linguistics, you know, feminists. I mean, all kinds of stuff, because, you know, and if you've listened to some of them, since I get them from the library, if I get one that's boring, I'll give the guy about three lectures, And, you know, if I'm bored still, sometimes you start out bored, it takes a while. But if I'm bored after three lectures, you know, I'm out nothing. I don't listen anymore. I go to the next thing. So make use of that time anyway. And then also read good writers and good thinkers. I was really happy to see Mike when I, you know, left him waiting at the airport for hours in Regina, said he was reading Touchstone. And I suggest that you throw theological journals in your car so that you have them with you when you're stuck waiting, you know, in line at the bank or at the doctor's. You know, you're always, it's always happening. What I did on this airplane ride was I brought those two old textbooks from the Craddock and the Lowry one, which I'd already read and didn't really want to read again, but thought I better freshen up on this stuff. And I didn't bring anything else to read, so I didn't have any choice. I just kind of forced myself, you know, so I got a 10-hour trip. I read through both books. I would have never done it if I'd had something else that could have, you know, been more interesting. So kind of denying yourself these things, some, you know, but that will help. I suggest, as writers that I find very helpful, Patrick Henry Reardon, who writes for Touchstone, he's also, I think I put at least one of his books on that suggested reading title list. And Anthony Esselin is a very good, so Patrick Henry Reardon is an Eastern Orthodox priest in Chicago. Anthony Esselin is an English professor, Roman Catholic layman, really, I find him a profound writer. Frederica Matthew Green, if you don't know her, she writes sometimes for Touchstone. She has a lot of essays on the internet. I used part of one of her essays on Christmas Day this year because she talked about our youngest son is autistic. So she has an autistic grandchild. So I was reading this article she wrote, and I'm not reading it for Christmas sermon preparation. I'm reading it because I have an autistic kid, and she has an autistic, and she's a great writer, and I love her, and she's a great thinker. So I'm reading this essay, and she talks about in it. She brings up this thing about when mothers, newborn babies, and the mother's holding the baby, and of course the baby the first day is sleeping. And what does the mother say? Open your eyes so I can see you. Right? Well, I mean, this is perfect because this is one of those universal, absolutely true. We've seen it, we've done it, we've said it. And she says, why does the mother say this? Well, because, you know, there is this idea that just looking at the baby's body isn't communicating with the baby and isn't knowing the baby. And what the mother means is, I want to get to know you. So this is a great, could you imagine St. Mary on Christmas Day saying to Jesus, open your eyes, I want to see you. And now can you imagine God saying to us, you know, this is the kind of delight that God takes in us. He wants to know us. Right, I mean, this is the kind of affection, like a, you know. So it worked, I think. And you know, I found it totally accidental, and I just went, bam! I just thought it was great, worked well, and she's a great. Eugene Peterson is a Presbyterian pastor. He's written a lot of books. Good writer, thoughtful writer. None of these people are Orthodox. I mean, they're not Orthodox Lutherans, but. You know, you can learn something from them, even if you're not learning from them theologically, you're just learning how to think, you're learning how to write. Also, I think that there's a lot of merit to comedy. Both Eugene Lowry and Fred Craddock talk about this to some degree. It's because this, like the punchline of a joke, and learning timing. So I suggest also, particularly funny writers, you can do this with comedians too. Try to do a little analysis. How does this work? Why are they, you know, how does a joke work? Because there's something in a joke that is universal to communication, holding people's attention and making a point. Well, the hardest way to be funny is in writing, I think. It's a lot easier to tell a joke than to write a joke. The best funny writers, in my opinion, Dave Barry, I mean, I have tears running down my face from Dave Barry. And there are a lot of things you can learn from Barry about. There's just all sorts of stuff he does. You know, he kind of plays against the cliche of catchphrases with catchphrases. He's got a lot of timing stuff, a lot of kind of vocabulary games he'll play, where he's like, you know, sophisticated thing, and then common thing in a way that shocks you Dave Barry's very good. Though you may not like their politics, though I do, Ann Coulter is unbelievably sharp. And again, what's that?
I said I have every single one of her books.
And, I mean, if you hate her politics, just get something from the library. But you can learn something from how she sets things up, because it's rhetoric. That's what she's doing. It's just rhetoric, and you can learn from her technique. And I would give you a moderate or a left wing political writer, but I don't read them, and I don't know of any of them that are funny. Maybe they are. Mark Stein, you've probably heard of. I love Mark Stein also. He is very funny and very good at this. Kind of set and learning how to set it up, how to wait and how to time it. Those are my things on writer's block. So we covered that kind of quickly. I hope it was some idea. We're supposed to go to 9:45. Is that what you told me? Or
well,
done now?
Take a break now.
Take a break now. Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah, perfect. And we'll get into sermon form then.